Good afternoon. I would like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, May 1st, and let the record reflect it is 1:18 p.m. Today we have present Representative Johnson, Representative Carpenter, Representative Gray, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Linda with House Records. Welcome, and Talia Ames from the Juno LIO. Thank you for your work. On today's agenda, the committee will hear House Bill 129, Voter Registration by House Judiciary Committee in its first hearing. We will take up House Bill 129, and we do have, after the presentation, I'd just like to note for the members, we have Michaela Thompson from the Division of Elections, Ms. Carol Beecher, the Director of the Division of Elections, and Thomas Flynn, who is the Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law, who advises the Division regarding elections. So, Mr. Almeida, if you would state your name for the record and begin the bill presentation on House Bill 129.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jake Almeida, Chief of Staff to Rep Vance, and committee aide to this committee. So before you is House Bill 129. This is a House Judiciary Committee bill. This just passed from the House State Affairs Committee last week. And this act primarily deals with voter registration. And so I will now read some prepared remarks. This election bill is a compilation of several years of work that began in the other body to reform our state's elections with the intent to restore integrity of the process and ultimately build the public trust in our most sacred institution, the right of the people to vote. This concept was previously part of a bipartisan bicameral package. Unfortunately, the bill was a casualty the last days of session last year and did not make it across the finish line. The bill before you today is a result of the lessons learned from conversations and concepts about what reform is most effective and can receive the most support. The need to bring election reform comes from the outcry of the people of Alaska. For many years, voters have been highlighting various issues and the clear lack of trust in our election process. Many believe the concerns to be mere speculation, but the results could not be more clear than a 44% voter turnout in the 2022 general election, one of the lower turnouts in general elections in our state's history, in decades, actually, as we got that confirmed. Article 1, Section 2 of Alaska's Constitution says all political power is inherent in the people. All government originates with the people, is founded upon their will only, and is instituted solely for the good of the people as a whole. Alaskans have spoken. It is time to focus our efforts on the foundation of our government, the voter. Article 5 of our Alaska Constitution also acts as a basic framework for our elections and gives authority to the legislature to prescribe qualifications, disqualifications, methods of voting, precincts, and registration by law. So, House Bill 129 tackles Alaska's overinflated voter rolls that are estimated to be around 121%. The challenge facing the Division of Elections to maintain current and accurate voter rolls is exacerbated by a highly transient population that we have here in Alaska. Automatic voter registration of the permanent fund dividend application and a current law that allows individuals to stay registered in the state as long as they have a intent to return. That will be a phrase that's used throughout the discussion of this bill are all reasons why our state is dealing with a higher than normal voter registration that other states don't have for those factors just explained. House Bill 129 also addresses these concerns by requiring the director to send letters to confirm the addresses of all voters not domiciled in Alaska in a more clear system for the voter to cancel their registration. Furthermore, this bill adopts best practices for verifying valid Alaskan voter status with multiple databases. Alaska is currently part of the ERIC system and does not have a 50-state data comparison in place to assure those voting in Alaska are within the state and are qualified to vote. This bill mandates adoption of a best practice voter registration system with a written maintenance schedule. The foundation of a secure and trustworthy election begins with accurate voter rolls. Over-registering voters makes our election system inaccurate and vulnerable to the actions of bad actors. Compromised data invites those with nefarious intent to exploit inactive voters and invites those who do not live in Alaska to influence our elections. House Bill 129 provides clear direction to help clean up our voter rolls to reflect a more accurate representation of the Alaskan electorate to build trust in our system. And I will just note, I used the word domiciled a few times. I meant to redact that from my script. The first version of the bill that went before the State Affairs Committee, version alpha, that used the word domicile. The version currently before you does not deal with that, as we had a complete rewrite of section one, and I will go through that in the sectional. But first, I will walk the committee through a brief slideshow presentation. So I had touched on this earlier. Why does Alaska have 106 to 120%? Those are the numbers that we've heard in discussion with the Division of Elections. A transit population, an intent, kind of an ambiguous intent to return language in law, and then the voter initiative, PFD, automatic voter registration, has also played a huge role in why we have over-registration in our system.
Ms. Shomalita, before you continue, I'd like to note for the record that we've been joined by Representative Groh at 1:20 p.m. and Representative Eastman at 1:25 p.m. Question by Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And I wanted to hit on it before we move forward. Can you go back to the first slide?
Yes.
The one with the... So it says 106%, but we've heard, which I haven't seen anything in writing yet, for 100 and potentially 20% of voter registration rate. So I don't want to go off of what a reporter is reporting. I wanted to go off of exactly what the Department of Elections has said. Do we have a precise percentage?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Allard, the last number we got was closer to 120%, and that was in discussion with the Division of Elections, is my understanding. And we do have them. We have the director, Ms. Carol Beecher, online for questions, and we can – it's up to the chair if we'd like to take questions at the end or during.
Vice Chair Allard, we can provide the sheet of documentation on that number. But if you'd like to ask the division question right now, we can do that.
I would like to ask Director Beecher, only because I want it on public record for the public to hear. Director Beecher, are you there by any chance through the chair?
Yes, this is Carol Beecher, Director of the Division of Elections. And through the chair, I have online Michaela Thompson, and I'm going to ask her to respond to this question.
Thank you.
For the record, Michaela Thompson with the Division of Elections, through the Chair, Representative Allard. I do not have that statistical information available in front of me currently, but that's something we can provide to the committee at a later date.
Thank you. Have you ever, have you had that question posed to you in the past? And do you know where we're coming up with that information of 120% if you don't know offhand? I would think that would be an important number to know.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I do not know where that number has come from. It's not something we typically have on our website, how much we are compared to the adult voting population in the census compared to how many we have registered to vote. That's not something that we have previously reported on, and I'm unsure of where that number has come from.
So just for, through the chair, so may I, Madam Chair,
follow up?
Thank you. So just for clarification, the Division of Elections doesn't know the percentage of voter registration rate in the state of Alaska on the phone today.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, that is correct. I do not have that number currently in front of me right now.
Maybe one more follow-up. Thank you. So we're going to be here for a little bit. Do you think you can get that number for us so we can circle back around and get that answer, please?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I can see what I can work on here before the end of the hearing.
Thank you. I would appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair, for that leeway.
Please continue.
Thank you. So we were on the next slide. This outlines what we're doing in the bill. The Division of Elections shall adopt regulations for an annual review of data breaches. That's been a historical issue that our state has had recently. Compare eligible voters, specify databases, have a maintenance schedule of our systems, and then a more clear registration cancellation process. Another highlight of the bill in section one. For the annual review, the director shall examine the master register and send a notice requesting address confirmation or correction to each voter. The notice must explain to the voter that their registration will be inactivated unless they respond within 45 days. If a voter does not respond within 45 days, the director shall inactivate the voter's registration. And I will get more in depth on that once we get to the sectional. The bill also outlines a review for data breaches. Regulations must provide for review of the register for data breaches. State officials have said that outside actors access the data through a flaw in their online voter registration system. I believe this was 2 or 3 years ago, which has since been patched. They were able to pull registered voters. The hackers were able to pull their registered voters' names, date of birth, state ID numbers, and the last four digits of their social security number, address, and party affiliation. And this was approximately about 119,000 Alaskans was the total at the time when the breach happened. And so that was another impetus for why we wanted to tighten this process up in the bill. And then next, compare persons eligible to vote in other states. Within the state, deceased voters, felons, those not qualified to vote under 1505, persons registered to vote in another state. And then specify the databases. So the regulations must specify records and databases for use in reviewing the master register, such as the USPS National Change of Address Database, the Electronic Registration Information Center, the DMV records, the Department of Corrections, property and sales tax records, Social Security records, Municipal Assessor Database, Social Security Administration Death Index, Alien Database by Homeland Security, and jury duty records is currently referenced in the bill, but that may be a redundancy because we had confirmation from the Alaska court system that the jury duty records are simply just information retrieved based on the permanent fund data. So that's where the court system gets their data. And so it's not a unique or original set of data that the court system has. It's what we already have. Again, touching on the maintenance schedule, the director shall develop a written maintenance schedule and guideline manual for the system and provide a report on the system to the legislature on the first day of each session and inform a voter of the criteria to qualify as a voter and penalties for misconduct. Registration cancellation. The director shall develop a process to allow a voter to cancel the voter's registration in person before an election official or electronically. And the instructions on how to do that must be displayed for a voter to cancel their registration at each polling place. And that concludes the presentation. I will finally walk us through a sectional. Section 1 of the bill amends AS 1507-130A to require the director to send a notice requesting address confirmation to individuals who have taken actions that would indicate a potential change in their residency. So this was a big change that we made from version alpha of the bill when it was in the State Affairs Committee. Previously, the bill had just mentioned if the voter is not domiciled in the state. The definition on what that means and whether someone is domiciled in the state is not clear. So we kind of rewrote that section, and specifically in section one, is directing the director to send a notice that a voter's registration will be inactivated unless they respond to a notice within 45 days, and they shall send the notice to each voter. In subsections 1 and 2 is existing law, and then in subsection 3 on section 1, we're adding new language that gets more after what we were seeing as issues. And these are for individuals who, after registering to vote in this state and in 2 years immediately preceding the examination, they've registered to vote in another state, they've received a driver's license in another state, they've registered a vehicle in another state, they're receiving public assistance in another state, they've served on a jury in another state, they've obtained a resident hunting or fishing license in another state, or have moved to a different residence, according to information from the USPS National Change of Address Program. So if the division finds that there are voters who have taken any of these actions under subsection 3, the bill would make the director send a notice to that voter to confirm their address and to confirm their residency. If they do not respond within 45 days, they would be inactivated. And so to be clear, and that does move us into section 2 of the bill, if a voter does not respond within 45 days of receiving the notice from the division, they will simply be inactivated, but they will not be removed from the master register, as that would be a violation of the, I'll call it Motor Voter, but it's the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, passed by Congress, and it's commonly referred to as Motor Voter, so that's what I'll be saying. So they would simply just be inactivated, and all that would mean practically, and again, we have the division to correct me, but they would have to re-register themselves if they are, in fact, still a resident of the state. But if the division does not receive a notice within 45 days, their status will be changed to an inactive voter in the state of Alaska, and they would have to take an intentional action to reactivate themselves. But again, they would not be removed from the master register. It would still be the two-year or the two-election cycle existing statute that wouldn't be in place to then have them removed. So it's always a longer process. It would not be a matter of someone getting a license in another state and now they're going to be removed from the voter rolls here in Alaska. That's not what the bill is doing. So I wanted to make that clear for the record. Section 3, again, following the same theme, ensures that the division is including a prepaid or pre-addressed return card with the notice to the voter, so that postage is covered when they send that in. Section 4 amends AS 1507130 to require the division to adopt best practice regulations to ensure that multiple databases are being used to cross-check the master register utilizing multiple databases. So the idea being that the state of Alaska is not simply relying on a system like ERIC. We're using ERIC among other systems at the same time that the division feels is best practices for accurate data on who is a resident or where residency may have changed. So that's what is being enforced for the division on Section 4, that we're having multiple cross-checks going on so that the master register has high confidence to the voters that it is accurate. In Section 5, amends adds a new section for the process of canceling registration. The director shall develop a process to allow a voter to cancel their registration in person before an election official or electronically, and the director shall display these instructions to the voter at each polling place. And then Section 6 is the uncodified effective date. So that is House Bill 29, Version B. And again, we have Division of Elections and Mr. Tom Flynn from the Department of Law for legal questions about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Mita. Questions from committee members. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. One of my questions is in regards to House Bill 129. After hearing the bill earlier, I think I have some concerns about the 45 days. And I also wanted to know, is there in House Bill 29, where there are certain examples or individuals that are exempt from the 90, or technically right now the 45 days requirement? I might just be missing it.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Allard, your section two, you're referring to section two?
Okay.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Through the chair, I am not seeing if there's a specific exemption clause. Could you potentially expand on what you're referring to?
I would say individuals who are deployed, whether it's either pilots, whether it's military personnel, people that are overseas for various reasons, people who are traveling, 45 days might not be enough. And I would definitely say it's not enough for a military person to respond. Do you have any, through the chair, I apologize, I should be going through the chair. Do you have any input or insight on that?
Not particularly. We do have Tom Flynn online from the Department of Law. He may be able to share some insight on that. I will say previously in State Affairs, we did ask the division director about the 45-day timeline, and she did not express, she can correct me, but there was not an expression of that not being enough time when this amendment was passed in the State Affairs Committee last week.
Mr. Flynn, are you available to answer the reasoning behind 45 days notice, if that is sufficient time?
Chair Vance, this is Tom Flynn at the Department of Law. The 45 days is an existing statute, so that's unchanged. And I just also note that if you're an inactivated voter, and you go to vote, you essentially spring back into activation and could vote. And as to whether 45 days is reasonable, that seems like a policy decision for you all.
May I do a follow-up?
Follow-up, Vice Chair Allard?
Thank you. I sit on the State Affairs Committee, and mulling it over for a little bit and how it could impact different individuals, especially our military persons or people who are traveling. We do have a lot of snowbirds who travel and go overseas in other areas. I think we're going to have to look at extending that potentially. I do have another question, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. It's in reference to slide number 5. Thank you. Through the chair, on slide number 5, there was a breach, and it says that it was patched. Sounds like a Band-Aid. Could you potentially, is there anybody on the line to say, what does patch actually need in the IT definition of how it was fixed and how it was penetrated and who penetrated it? And were there any consequences to the actions of all these files being opened and accessed?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Allard, that would be a question for Director Beecher. And this is in reference to the data hack, I believe, of 2 or 3 years ago, but she can correct me.
This is Carol Beecher, Director, through the chair, Representative Allard. That is a multi-pronged question. We do have the data to be able to answer at least a good number of your questions, but if you would indulge us, we would prefer to provide that in writing.
Thank you. And through the chair,
follow up.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. The term outside actors just seems so lame as far as using that term instead of actually what they are, hackers. But outside actors just seem so, I don't know, unprofessional. So I guess I'm just trying to find out in depth of that. And yes, I would be more than happy to get that in writing. Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, one more.
Follow-up, Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, licenses from another state. Can you reiterate what you said in regards to just because they have a license in another state doesn't, I might be wrong, doesn't automatically exempt them? Is that what you said?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Allard, that's correct. Snowbirds would be the example. There are people who can maintain their residency in Alaska but not live here during the winter. And there may be some states that require that if you're going to be living there for more than 30 days, that you need to have a driver's license, or if you're going to hunt in that state, that you would have to have another license. there are many scenarios that are not always common that can be thought of, but we probably would meet people or have met people that have that other license, but they are still maintaining their residency, their primary residency is still in Alaska. So that's what that entails.
Let me do a quick follow-up.
Follow-up?
So, okay, let me get this straight. So if you're in the state of Alaska and you're military, I'm going to use military as an example. You come here and you're in the state of Alaska. If you're here for longer, I think 30 days, I might be wrong. Representative Gray might know. No? You don't know? Okay.
I'm listening.
Okay. I think it's 30 days. It might be 60. You are required to get a driver's license from the state of Alaska. I'd have to follow up. What's that? So there is something when you're on active duty, as an active duty soldier. Not quite positive. They might give them the leeway on that as an exception to the rule. But if you're in the state of Alaska, if you're, say, you're a resident of Alaska and you go down and you're snowbirding, say, in Oregon, and they have a driver's license in Oregon, I'm concerned that there's other states that because you have a driver's license that they're going to automatically register you to vote. And I don't know if we have checks and balances to prevent that. It's a loaded question. I know those have to get back, and I'll jot down a whole bunch of others.
Vice Chair Allard, I will take this question. If you look on page 1, number 2, one of the markers is that who has not contacted. The division will look at the list, mm-hmm. and if someone has been inactive under 2 years, they're going to send out this notification card. So number 2 says who has not contacted the division, and then in the 2 years immediately preceding the examination of the register, and who has not voted or appeared to vote in the 2 years immediately preceding. So they have to reach those markers that they have not been voting. And then if the division finds that these other markers that may indicate that they are wanting to be a resident in another state, like registering to vote in another state, a driver's license, registering a vehicle in another state. And then if they have and they don't respond to the card within the 45 days, the division then has the ability to move them to the inactive voter registration list. They can reactivate by voting, but they are not on the active registration list. So just because what Mr. Almeida was clarifying earlier is just because someone may have a license in another state doesn't automatically boot them from the voter registration list. Does that answer your question?
A little bit. It's okay.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
I don't
have anything. Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thanks for the chair. I think the actual date is 90 days. You have up to 90 days to continue to drive in Alaska on a previously issued prior state license. But there is a requirement after 90 days to make sure if you're going to keep driving, you have to have an Alaska license. So I know there's a statute to that effect. My question is, there's obviously a lot of movement involved with being in the military. And I can speak to that, you know, from personal experience. And there was times when we were deployed or when we were out of state, the military would send us mail and we'd wonder how many times it circled the globe before it got to us, because it took several months and appeared to, who knows where it went to. I remember looking at the computer screen and seeing that our equipment from Alaska that was supposed to go with us to a deployment was in Djibouti for no particular reason, because the RFID tag said Djibouti. You know, didn't seem to make a lot of sense to me, but I knew on the receiving end that mail was delayed. Sometimes it wouldn't arrive. Sometimes it took a very circuitous route to get there, which was something of a mystery. Would the sponsor be amenable to simply exempting those who are active duty military from some of these requirements, given that, you know, we could sort of hassle on whether 45 days is the right number, or we could make it longer or shorter, or maybe we could just recognize as another option that if you're active military, you're moving around a lot, so that requirement maybe isn't appropriate to someone who's deployed, for example.
Representative Eastman, I think maybe getting insight from the Division of Elections of what the current process is they use for the military. maybe a great place to start. So I'm wondering, Mr. Flynn, are you available to answer questions regarding what the current process is the division uses with military members who are overseas?
Chair Vance, this is Tom Flynn of the Department of Law. I can start answering that, but the others from the division on the phone might have to back me up. I mean, as far as voter registration, I'm not aware that military members are really treated much different. I mean, there are different rules for when they get ballots mailed to them, absentee ballots, and the amount of time that overseas voters have to return them. But I don't think they're treated differently for voter registration purposes, and I might look to Michaela or the director to correct me.
Ms. Beecher, do you have any further insight on overseas military members and voter registration?
This is Carol Beecher, director. I don't have that answer in front of me, but I am going to throw that one to Michaela Thompson, please.
For the record, Michaela Thompson, Division of Elections, Chair Vance. In regards to our military and overseas voters for absentee voting and registration, they are exempt from the intent to return, and that's on the federal level. They don't have to have that intent to return. They can vote in the state where they were last, where they last established residency while they're active in military, while they're moving around.
Representative Eastman, does that answer your question?
No, I understand the process. My question is, you know, to those who have been working on the bill, is there any interest in maybe you know, creating an exemption for those who are in the status of being active duty military?
Representative Eastman, I am open to obviously having that conversation to see if with them being exempt from the intent to return, if it's implied. And I think we can definitely talk to legal about how we would word that so that they don't fall in this loop of not receiving notification. I will say that one of the reasons that I added the ability to respond via email is to be able to close the gap on a postcard getting lost in the mail and modernizing our process. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you.
Thank you. I am, through the chair, a little bit concerned in regards to the exception point for military of the intent to return, because it filters into the PFD, where that's where we get our voter rolls. And I'm concerned that it would actually tangle things up, because those are directly correlated with the intent to return. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Groh.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask either the Department of Law or the Division of Elections, or both, a series of questions, and then I may have some questions for the sponsor. The first question I have is, without passing this bill, how much of the list that is set out in on the top of page 2 of the bill is currently disqualification for voter registration? I mean, in the sense of, I'd like to know more about exactly how that works in terms of what occurs under current law, current practice.
This is Carol Beecher, through the chair, Representative Groh. If I could ask you some clarification on your question, are you referring to the addition of number 3 that has A through F, or A through G, I'm sorry?
Right. Exactly. How much is what process occurs now, and both in terms of checking or exploration, and what are the actions taken now? Because, you know, these are things that seem to be, you know, useful disqualifications, and I'm just trying to understand more completely what's occurring now, and that's related to my other question, may be helpful to understand. Another of my questions is, how much of this bill, what this bill does or seeks to accomplish, can already be done, and in terms of what already is done and what already can be done. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Carol Beecher, Representative Groh. So the way that is currently done with contacting people and examining the master register is that we send a non-forwardable mail to the voter's registration mailing address every year if they have not voted, or if they have not appeared to vote, then we send out the first one non-forwardable. The second, if they don't respond to that, then we send out a second one that is forwardable. And then if they don't respond to that, then they are put on the inactive list. As regards the things that we're already doing in number three, we already know if they're registered to vote in another state, partly through the group called ERIC that we're a member of, and we are also sometimes contacted by the other state to see if they are registered to vote, or if they notice that someone has noted that they're registered to vote in another state. And we also, through ERIC and through some of our information, we know if they've received a driver's license from another state. And in number G, if they have moved to a different residence, according to the U.S. Postal Service through that National Change of Address program, ERIC is part of that. And so through the participating states, we also know that information. As for C, D, E, and F, the registered vehicle, if they've received public assistance, if they've served on a jury, or if they've obtained a resident hunting or fishing license, we don't have that information or access to it with other states. So that is not something that we are currently getting information on.
Paula? So when you do get this information, what do you do, right? If you, in terms of the information that you do get, what is the process?
Through the chair, Representative Grow, I'm going to ask Michaela to answer that. She can give you a more thorough answer to that as she has undergone the process.
For the record, Michaela Thompson, Division of Elections, through the chair, Representative. It depends on the data that we receive. For example, if it's data from vital statistics for deceased voters, we're able to remove those voters from the list immediately. For the information we receive from ERIC, we take that information and we send a mailer to those voters, and the voters have a chance to respond to that mailer, and they can do so by either calling us or by returning the mailer and canceling their registration, or they can confirm their current Alaska residence address to stay as a registered voter in Alaska.
Follow-up? What's the difference between inactivating a voter's registration and revoking it? Could we describe the different statuses we have under current law, please?
Through the chair, Representative, inactivating the record is when either a voter contacts us and they tell us that they're now registered into another state, or we receive other information from another state agent, state voter registration agency, directly that they're now registered in the other state, or they go through the list maintenance process and then they're put into that inactive status. I think revoking, and how you're talking about that, would kind of be in the context of those voters that may have committed felonies of moral turpitude who no longer are eligible to be registered voters in the state. And then we get those lists from the Alaska courts, and we're able to put those into an inactive status.
Follow up. You mentioned ERIC in your testimony. I seem to recall reading a media report about some thinking or speculation or discussion by the state of withdrawing from ERIC. Can you describe the current status of the state of Alaska's relationship with ERIC, and also describe what it is more fully?
To Through the chair, Representative, I'm going to ask the director to speak on this item.
Carol Beecher, for the record, through the chair, Representative Groh. The ERIC is a member organization that has currently 27 states as members. And what ERIC does is the participating members, we provide every 60 days the Division of Motor Vehicles information and our voter registration list. And what they do with that then is with all of the data that they get from these participating states, then they provide us with lists. And the lists are, the main lists are eligible but inactive, or eligible but not registered voters, registered voters who look like they've registered in another state. They have access to the Social Security Death Index, so information on death, people who may have died in another state who we have registered, things that pertain to the information that would be germane to Alaska is what we're provided. There are also some reports that we can get from them that we can request. And so when we get these reports, then what we do is check it against our voter registration to put them in whatever status is required based on that information.
Is it my understanding then that the state of Alaska intends to stay in ERIC?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, at this time we are still evaluating ERIC for efficiency, for seeing what's going to happen across the country. We get a lot of information from several states and not as much from others, so we're also looking to see what happens there. So we're evaluating the efficacy of the program. But at this time, we have not made a decision on that, and we are continuing to participate as members.
Follow up. Turning to Section 5 of the bill, which creates a process for the director to cancel registration, and if we're going to create a process for a voter to remove themselves, why not add, is it a good idea to add that as a form mailed to individuals with their voter packet?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, I'm going to ask Michaela Thompson to answer the what is currently provided on the postcard that we send to them. Michaela?
For the record, Michaela Thompson, Division of Elections, through the chair, Representative. The current postcard allows them to return it in writing, or they can contact us by email or over the phone. Currently, the division, for anybody, even if they don't receive an ERIC mailer, someone can cancel their registration through writing, or they can call a division office.
Thank you. I may have more questions later.
Vice Chair Allen.
Thank you. I'm not sure who could answer it, but through the chair, I want to say it probably be Division of Elections. How many voters in 2021 did we remove from our voter registration, or as early as 2022?
Representative, this is Carol Beecher, Division of Elections, through the chair, Representative Allard. We can get that information to you.
May I do a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Without sounding too hard, we're here asking these questions to look for answers, and it sounds like you guys don't have any, or you're not prepared for this meeting. But I also want to ask, what if we have someone who voted in another state? What happens to that voter if we find that out?
Through the chair, Representative Alex Carol Beecher, if someone is registered to vote in Alaska and votes in another state, my understanding is technically they can do that as long as they don't also vote in Alaska. They are not precluded from being registered to vote in two states, but they can only vote in one.
I apologize. Let me rephrase that question. When a voter has voted in another state who is also an Alaska resident, and then they voted here too, what do we do in a situation like that?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Allard, thank you for the clarification. If that was to happen, then what we would generally, the process is if when we find that out, we contact the other state or the other state contacts us, and then an investigation is launched in to see because it could potentially be a criminal act, depending on intent and all of the criminal elements involved.
I have a whole list of names to give you from the municipality. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. So through the chair, I have Alaska statute section 15.07.130 that I've been reading about how we currently do things. It seems that a lot of the statute is in the bill. So I'm wondering if we could learn exactly what is new in the bill that's not in the statute. Just for example, the 45-day response to the card, if any of these things happen, a lot of that is already in statute. I'm not an expert. So what I want to know is what exactly is new in the bill that is not currently in statute? And I don't know who the best person is.
Refidies. Back on the record, we apologize. We are getting our drafter from Legislative Legal Services, Mr. Noah Klein. Thank you so much for making yourself available to answer questions. Representative Gray, you had questions for our drafter.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I was just curious about exactly, it seems to me that a lot of the changes are small between what the bill is doing and the actual statute. So I just wanted to make sure that I was clearly understanding what the differences are between current statute and what the bill is addressing. I really, if I could just have a summary of how the bill changes the statute in a substantive way.
Through the chair, for the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, please continue.
Through the chair to Representative Gray, I believe that the sponsor would have given a sectional, but in terms of what's changing, I can go through the first couple of sections of the bill if that's helpful. So there's an addition of providing the notice to the voter's electronic email address if it's available. The notice explanation language on page 1, lines 8 through 11, that currently is existing in law, but under current law, there's a two-notice process, and the bill is moving to a single notice. So under current law, there is a first non-forwardable notice that is sent for specific reasons that are still in law, and then in this bill, there's also additional reasons being added for sending the notice. And then if certain things occur that are currently in 1507.130b, then a second notice is sent and the 45-day time period kicks in. So the 45-day time period, how the second notice is treated, that's all the same, but the bill is adding additional reasons for sending the notice and shifting to a single notice framework. And then, for example, Section 3 is just the conforming change, identifying that the notice is being sent under A as opposed to under Subsection B, but the way the notice is treated is identical. And then subsections 4 and 5 are adding new provisions of law.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. I certainly appreciate that you boil things down into common language. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Gray?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do not have a follow-up for Noah. Thank you. That was very helpful.
Wow. That means he did fantastic. I'm so impressed. Any further questions for you?
I do. I have additional questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Do we have additional questions for Mr. Klein while we have him online?
Madam Chair, I would just add very quickly, since the section was just talked about based on Representative Gray's question, On page 1, line 6, on the non-forwardable mail, it was pointed out by Mr. Klein from Legal Services that that will likely need to be changed. The Federal Motor Voter Act does not allow states to do a single notice of non-forwardable. If states want to do one notice only, like as we are proposing in this legislation, then it has to be forwardable. So page 1, line 6 will likely need to be, that was existing law, but because the CS did not address that, that will likely need to be a change to forwardable mail so that the state is in alignment or is not in violation of the Motor Voter Act. I just wanted to add that.
Representative Eastman, you had a question for Mr. Klein.
I do. Thank you, and through the chair. Mr. Klein, I see at the beginning of the bill, line 4, at times of the director's choosing, and so we're giving some discretion to the director. And then I see, you know, requirements concerning the notice that are appearing on lines 4 through lines 10. Before you get to the point of providing a list of basically the criteria for the director to create the list that these notices are going to be going to, it's not immediately clear to me if there is discretion that the director is given to send the notice to people in addition to those provided on lines 10 and following. Can you speak to that if we're giving discretion to the director at times of their choosing to send out these notices, is there discretion given for the director to send notices out to more people than it's absolutely required to in the language of the bill?
For the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, to the chair, to Representative Eastman. The discretion that's provided in the first sentence is current law, and that's simply discretion on the timing of the notice. That's discretion to send it at times of the director's choosing, but no less than, or not less frequently than January of each year, but that's not providing additional discretion to the director to send the notice for additional reasons.
Thank you. Follow up?
And
Mr. Klein, can you speak to, if not, I can ask somebody else, but can you speak to what portions of the requirements that are spelled out on page 2, lines 3 and following, but what of that is coming from some federal law or statute versus is just our own ideas as a state?
For the record, again, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Representative Eastman. I couldn't speak to any policy choices behind why something is or is not in a bill. I'm not aware of that list being the same as any specific requirements in federal or other law.
Representative Grubb.
Mr. Eastman, Representative Eastman has asked the questions I would have.
Any further questions for the drafter? Thank you, Mr. Klein, for making yourself available. Any further questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, on page 2 of the bill, lines 3 through 14, what we've been talking about, I'm just curious about, it sounds like that ERIC is the system from which we would be notified about this, or can you just, can the Division of Elections just talk a little bit about how they find out that folks have gotten a driver's license in another state, how folks have, whether they've registered to vote or not, whether they've registered their car or not. I just see a lot of things on here, and I was just curious about the process and how you guys discover that information.
Ms. Beecher, are you available to answer the question from Representative Gray?
Yes, Carol Beecher, Division Director, Division of Elections Director. Through the chair, Representative Gray. The way that we use ERIC is for those participating states where they are providing their DMV data and they're providing their voter registration information. And we also could hear from the voter themselves that they have changed to vote in another state or they may contact us with that information. And we also could potentially, we are not currently a member of the, or we don't have a license essentially for the National Change of Address program. So that's something that Eric also is a member of. So they can also provide us with that as regards to the different residence addresses. So for those specific things, that's where we get that information. For the information that is listed as C, if someone has registered a vehicle in another state, we do not currently have a way to get that information. We would not know if that happened. We also would not know if someone was receiving public assistance. We wouldn't know if somebody was serving on a jury, and we wouldn't know if they had obtained a hunting or fishing license in another state. We don't have a way of knowing even what state we would ask those questions to.
Follow up.
Is it the intention of the drafter of the bill that the Division of Elections will have to find a way to be able to do those things that we currently don't have a way to do?
Representative Gray, yes, we're having conversations with the division. These are simply markers to close the gap on people who are no longer residents in the state but may still be voting. And these are markers that clearly they are taking up residence in another state. So we are working through governmental databases as a means of reliable information that the division can use to find people who should not be on our voter rolls.
Follow up. So is it the intention that we're offering the Division of Elections some options, but not necessarily saying that they have to do this? Because I'm thinking also, if a state doesn't participate in ERIC, well, then it seems like the Division of Elections would be almost mandated to reach directly out to those states and ask, and I don't know how to really do that, and maybe the Division of Elections does, how you ask, do you have people from Alaska there, but how would they know?
Representative Gray, what this list does is provides the authority for the division, if they were able to find this information, that gives them a reason, along with the others listed in bullet point number 1 and 2, to be able to contact the voter and say, we see these markers indicating that you may need to be moved to the inactive voter list. But they don't stand, it is not a requirement. It's just more authority for the division.
Follow up.
So Representative Gray.
I'll just offer this. I generally get in trouble when I offer a personal anecdote, but I've lived in many, many states. I've moved a lot. I have never notified anyone that I was canceling a voter registration. I don't vote in that state anymore. I moved on with my life. So I'm just putting that out there that kind of like most people who leave Alaska do not intend to ever vote in Alaska again. I just feel, with the exception of snowbirds, and I know there's exceptions, I know that our state does have this specific group of people who live in two places at once. So I get that we need to have some sort of process, but I just think a lot about the possible amount of resources that can be poured into getting verification from someone who's going to ignore them all because they never plan to vote here again. Does that make sense?
It does, Representative Gray.
Madam Chair, and if I might, page 2 on line 2, we do have the or. We have the distinction of that. So that, hopefully that does help.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you to Representative Gray's earlier comment. You know, there's any number of things you can do to establish residency as an Alaskan, to maintain residency as an Alaskan, and there's people who do leave Alaska who, for good and bad reasons, want to keep receiving a permanent fund dividend. And one of the things you can do is, you know, continue to be registered, continue to vote, those types of things. That would seem to me it's somewhat of a unique factor here in Alaska compared to 49 other states. Just something to keep in mind. Question? Thank you. Through the chair.
Is there anything in federal law that gives American citizens the right to be registered to vote in two states at the same time?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm not aware of that. We did just have Noah from Legal Services. I don't believe he's on the line anymore. I don't know. But,
okay. Follow-up? Okay.
Representative Eastman, I don't have an answer specifically to whether it is legally allowable to be able to vote in two states. I believe every American citizen has the right to vote in any state. They can vote a question. They would have to vote a question ballot. For instance, if a person was traveling during a presidential election, they could go and request a question ballot and vote only for that, the president of the United States that they would be qualified for if they were not an Alaskan resident. But as far as specifically what is legally allowable, I don't have a direct answer for you on that, but we can address that. And I apologize. We do have Thomas Flynn from the Department of Law available online if you would like to ask him that question.
Certainly, yeah. Let's please see if he's on the line.
Mr. Flynn, did you hear the question from Representative Eastman?
Yes, thank you, Chair Vance. This is Tom Flynn again. To Representative Eastman, I'm not aware of any requirement either at the federal level. I mean, as a general rule, states manage their own voter list subject to federal laws like the NVRA.
Follow up?
You
know, I'm looking at line 5, page 2 of the bill is talking about what happens when someone registers to vote in another state. And I'm just wondering, is there anything either in the Alaska Constitution or federally that would prevent Alaska from acknowledging that someone has taken the step of registering to vote in another state, and as such, that could trigger them no longer being registered in our state? Because if they don't have a right to be registered in two states, would that be a step that the state could look at taking?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, so I would point you to AS 1505-0104, which does say that you can't be registered to vote in another jurisdiction in order to be a qualified voter here. So I do know that the Division of Elections will cancel a voter registration if they hear from another state's Secretary of State or similar sort of body that someone's registered there. They'll cancel the voter registration here.
Can I follow up? And okay, thank you very much for that. If that's the case, maybe a question to the sponsor. It would seem to me like the way the language currently reads, we're not automatically canceling that voter who is subsequently registered to vote in another state or perhaps even voted in that other state. And we're, you know, leaving them in the process to go through a process which may or may not result in them being canceled. And I'm just wondering, is there utility in keeping them in the mix when I think currently we just heard they're removed from the mix once they take that step?
Madam Chair, to the Chair, Representative Eastman, that would be a question for the Division of Elections, because as Mr. Flynn answered that, I understood that if someone is registered in another state, that they would be that would be the question for the division. Are they inactivated or are they removed from the register? The line in question that you asked about is in the process of them just getting a notice to be inactivated, not removed from the master register. So that would be a question for, if I understood your question right, I think that should be for Ms. Beecher.
Restate the question. So thank you. So I'm not asking, you know, if there's a process by which we can keep them in an inactivated status, I get we could. I don't think there's a law against doing that. I'm saying, why would we if the state has the ability to acknowledge somebody's registered in another state, why would we want to put them into a registered but inactive status as opposed to simply acknowledging, you know, they're registered in Alabama. Alabama can take care of them and Alaska's done with them at that point.
Ms. Beecher, are you able to answer Representative Eastman's question?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm going to ask our legal, Tom Flynn, to answer that question.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, this is Tom Flynn again. Correct me if I'm missing your question, but I think part of the distinction here is it depends the way in which the division hears about a voter being registered elsewhere, right? If they just suspect a voter has moved, that's different than if another state through an official channel tells us that voter has registered there. And so in the first instance, a voter is going to be triggered for list maintenance under this statute. And in the other one, the division could take that as proof that the voter is registered somewhere else, if that makes sense.
Follow up. Yeah, and I'm just talking about, you know, when the state, through whatever means, finds out that someone's been registered in another state, whether the person comes up and comes to the till and says, hey, I registered in another state, or, you know, the state finds out some other way, is there any reason at that moment in time why the state wouldn't acknowledge that other state's registration and, as a consequence of that, remove them as a registered voter in Alaska?
Representative Eastman, so of the two examples you gave, if a voter tells the division they're registered elsewhere, they can take the voter at their word. If, for example, the division hears through the ERIC system that a voter appears to have moved, then that's not the same proof as a voter saying it, and that's where this list maintenance process with notices and periods before they can be removed kicks in.
Yeah, not talking about when somebody moves. I'm talking about when someone literally registers to vote in a state other than the state of Alaska.
Representative Eastman, Tom Flynn again through the chair. If the division understands that from another state tells this state that person is registered there, it's my understanding that they'll be removed from the voter registration list at that point.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard and then Representative Groh.
Thank you. Oh, I don't know what I did with my sheet. Ms. Beecher, through the chair, I appreciate everything you guys have done, and I know that everything's kind of getting thrown at you quickly since you're brand new. But I wanted to ask, is it possible that I could get information on how many new voters for Alaska that we've had since 2016 to current and broken down by each year? And is it also possible to find out how many voters we've lost from 2016 to present? And I know you can't get that now, but if you can get it for us, that would be appreciated. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Through the chair, this is Carol Beecher, Division of Elections, Representative Allard. We can provide you with that information.
Thank you, Ms. Beecher.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Beecher, we've had a lot of discussion with Eric, and I appreciate what we said before. It's kind of my intention that you've talked about a decision or a factor in keeping Eric as the cost. I understand that. What is your understanding of what it costs to maintain for the state of Alaska to stay a member of Eric?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, we have the documentation of how much it costs to be a member. We pay dues every year to be a member of ERIC. And then on top of that, depending on which lists we get and how we act on those lists, for example, the eligible but not registered list can be quite large sometimes. And if we send out mailers to everyone, which we do, when we use that list, as we're required to do as part of membership, that can also add to the amount of what it costs for us to be a member, because we're mandated to send that list out. So we have all those numbers, Representative Groh, and we're happy to provide those.
Follow-up. Ms. Beecher, I have heard that Eric has said that it costs $26,000 to be to maintain membership in ERIC. If that number is anything close to true, and given the substantial concerns, you know, this committee is members of this committee have expressed and other Alaskans about keeping close track of people registering other states to vote and doing some of these other acts that would suggest perhaps that they're not that it's problematic for them to vote in Alaska. It does strike me that that's cheap at the price, if that's what it costs. So thank you.
Representative Groh, I'd just like to clarify that this bill is not advocating that the state withdraw from ERIC, but use additional governmental databases to backfill the areas that ERIC cannot provide, because as was mentioned, there's currently only 27 states who are utilizing ERIC, and so we have a lot of gaps in the information, and this bill seeks to just add additional reliable sources of information to give more tools to the Division of Elections. So I just wanted to clarify if there was any concern that this bill was advocating for withdrawal of ERIC.
Madam Chair, just to briefly respond, I didn't doubt that as to about you. I was thinking that given that we're that you're not the one that's going to be running these voter rolls unless you have a surprising announcement to make at the end of this meeting, and that the Division of Elections is, that it's useful for the Division of Elections to have apparently an essential tool to make this work. Although, as you say, there obviously could be additional assets and resources that would help.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this is to the Division of Elections. Do we have automatic registration in Alaska? We are not automatic, but where you can register at the polls.
Through the chair, this is Carol Beecher, Division of Elections Director, Representative Johnson. For a federal presidential election, they can register the day of the election. For other elections, it's usually they have to be registered 30 days before an election. But I believe that there's I apologize, I'm still learning a lot of this. I believe that there is a shorter time frame to get an absentee ballot, and Michaela Thompson can give you the time frame on that.
That would be helpful.
For the record, Michaela Thompson with the Division of Election, through the chair, representative. The director is correct. We only have same day registration for the presidential race only. For all other races for elections, you have to be registered to vote by 30 days prior to election day. And that also applies to absentee ballots. They had to have been registered to vote by that deadline, too, in order to have a ballot sent to them.
So thank you, through the chair. So if I'm an Alaskan and I'm traveling in Arizona, or I'm from Arizona traveling to Alaska, I have to change my voter registration to vote in the presidential election? I thought that's what I just heard you say, is you had to register.
Through the chair, representative, if you're just traveling, you still are maintaining Alaska as your residence address. So you would still vote in Alaska. You would just request an absentee ballot, and you would still have been a registered voter in Alaska and have met the 30-day residence requirement, too.
Follow-up?
Not yet. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Vice Chair Allard. Thank you. I'm going to piggyback after Representative Johnson. So you said that in a presidential election, you can do a same-day vote. Does that mean you can only vote for the president, or is that ballot that you're going to hand them? How are you going to – is there like a separate ballot that only has the president on it, and then you have a different ballot with everybody else's name so you can make sure that that particular person doesn't vote down the ballot? Just for clarification, through the chair.
For the record, Michaela Thompson, through the chair, Representative Allard. In those situations, if someone went to go vote at the polling place and they were not on the register, they'd be directed to go vote a question ballot. In the question ballot, they'd fill all their information on the outside of the envelope. They would get the ballot that was there in the polling place, and they would vote their ballot, and then it would go to the question review board at the regional office, and the question review board would see that the person was not registered by the 30-day registration deadline, so they were only eligible for the presidential race. So when the ballot is counted, then only the presidential race will be counted. It's what we call a partial count ballot.
Okay. No more questions as of yet.
Representative Gray and then Representative Eason.
Thank you. My first question through the chair is to Thomas Flynn. I believe earlier in the meeting you talked about how if somebody didn't respond to the 45-day notice, all they would have to do to reactivate is vote. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, yes, that's my understanding. Inactivation is like a pre-cancellation status. It doesn't mean you're canceled. It means basically it's waiting for that two general election period before cancellation would happen. And you can reactivate by canceling the division, attempting to vote, that sort of thing.
Follow up. Could you register your vehicle in another state, serve on a jury in another state, obtain a hunting resident, a license in another state, and then come back and activate your voter registration by voting?
Representative Gray, I don't think any of those things would be disqualifying for your status as a inactive voter. So yes, you could go and do those things and come back and vote.
Thank you. One more question, different question.
Representative Gray.
And I'm not sure who the best person to answer the question is. So to everybody, through the chair, when I read the statute, section 15.07.130, it talks about notices being non-forwardable. And I assumed that a non-forwardable, I guess it's in section A, I'll be clear. In section A of the statute, it says that non-forwardable mail to the voter's registration mailing address requesting, you know, this is like, I guess, to maintain the voter roll, and you wouldn't want to forward it. Can somebody answer why we don't want it to be forwardable?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, this was one aspect that we noticed in the CS that will need to be changed. Mm-hmm. Because without this bill, where current law, we have two notices. Mm-hmm. If this bill passes, we'll have one notice. Mm-hmm. The Federal Motor Voter Act of 1993 says that upon the last notice, it has to be forwardable. So the way the bill's written, that would be a violation. We will need to change that to forwardable.
Roger.
Follow up.
So it's going to be fixed.
My follow up is just for my own curiosity. Why was it non-forwardable to begin with?
It was through the chair, it was two notices.
Correct. I guess I don't understand. Why was through the chair? Why was one forwardable and one non-forwardable?
That would be a question, I think, for the division. I mean, that was existing law. That was
Representative Gray. The first notice is non-forwardable. The second notice is forwardable.
Through the chair,
current law.
Why did we not do the first one forwardable? I'm just curious if there was like a voter fraud prevention strategy. I was curious.
Mr. Flynn, are you available to answer why the first notice was listed as being non-forwardable?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Gray. So under the current scheme of AS 1507-130, the first notice is non-forwardable because that notice has to be returned as undeliverable before the division can send the second notice. So the two-notice scheme requires this undeliverable aspect to it, and if it were forwardable, it would be deliverable. So that's why it's non-forwardable, at least in my reading.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Representative Eason.
Thank you, which begs the question. So if we're going to get to the point, some point where we find out that it's undeliverable, why don't we just figure that out at the beginning? Why go through the process, particularly for those things that are going to eventually be returned as unforwardable? Why don't we just start with the forwardable message rather than waiting for the printing of another message and the sending of another message to find that out.
Representative Eastman, was that a question for anyone in particular?
Yes, I'll direct that to Mr. Flynn, please.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I think that's a potential criticism for the current statutory scheme, and the one that this bill proposes, at least with the amendment that I understand to be coming, because it's required by federal law to make this forwardable, the fact of something being undeliverable is no longer a part of the requirement to remove someone from the voter rolls.
Thank you.
Any further questions from committee members? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And this is going to be for the division through the chair. When you're at a voting place, is the ballot that is being given to voters at that voting place, is that the same exact ballot that is given when it's sent by mail? I think there was some comment earlier about, if you just want to vote for the presidential election, you have a ballot that's got the president, it's got some other stuff on it. Maybe you only fill out the president part, or you fill out it all, but it only gets counted for the president part. Does the division have any other versions of those ballots, either a presidential-only ballot or a presidential ballot and statewide ballot measures ballot? Or is it all just one ballot?
For the record, Michaela Thompson of the Division of Elections, through the chair, Representative Eastman. The division does, for absentee voting, have a federal-only ballot, and those only have federal races on them, and those are sent to voters who are residing overseas permanently. And so they can only participate in the federal-only races. So that is the federal-only ballot that is sent to those voters in particular.
Follow up. Last time I helped run a poll and spent a little while, one of the options we had was to give a voter a ballot that allowed them to just vote on the ballot measures that were happening in that particular election. Can you speak to whether or not that still happens?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the ballot measures only ballot existed under the old primary system when we had different primary ballot options. And if there was a ballot measure on the primary ballot, then we would have a ballot measures only for that election in particular. And since we no longer have a party primary system where we have a ballot for each type of primary, we no longer have that.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to thank the Division of Elections for being available and Mr. Flynn with the Department of Law, and also Noah Klein for Legislative Legal Services for answering so many of the committee's questions. And for the sake of time, we're going to set House Bill 129 aside. I am setting an amendment deadline for this bill to be this Thursday, May 4th by 5 p.m. I'm also going to remind the committee that the amendment deadline for House Bill 11, Crime, Assault in the Presence of a Child by Rep. Josephson, is this Wednesday by 5 p.m. And I am setting an amendment deadline for House Bill 29, Insurance Discrimination by Rep. McCabe, to be tomorrow, Tuesday, May 2nd by 6 p.m. with the intent to move the bill out by Wednesday. And we will be sending a complimentary email with this list of amendment deadlines. And if you did not have shorthand to scribble it out quickly. So that concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Wednesday, May 3rd at 1 p.m. to bring back House Bill 129, voter registration, in its second hearing, and also House Bill 29. So we have 129 and 29, not to be confused, on Wednesday. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect it is 2:51 p.m.